So our next speaker is Todd Peterson from the DNR. He's going to be talking about the second part of the County Atlas series, which is part B, which focuses on hydrogeology. Todd is a hydrogeologist from the DNR. He's the data manager for the hydrogeology and groundwater unit in the Ecological and Water Resources Division. He has a BS in geology from the University of Minnesota and a master's in geophysics from Cornell, and over 30 years of experience in hydrogeology and geophysics. Welcome, Todd.
The DNR has been involved with the County Geologic Atlas Program since the early 1990s, following the 1989 Minnesota Groundwater Act from the state legislature. MGS continued to do instead of the whole atlas, they did the Part A geologic setting, which was just nicely described by Bob. And then the hydrogeology, it was done by DNR, so we've been in a partnership for some 26, 27 years. And we've developed a lot over that time, as you've seen from what Bob has come up with. It's interesting that we don't run out of work, we just do more things because we have more abilities with computers. But anyway, I'll be talking about what the County Atlas Part B program has been doing. As I said, the County Atlas started in the 1990s. Our CGA reports, methods, and procedures are now published online. I'm going to be talking about them, but you can find more detail online if you're interested in how we produce the maps and the assumptions we put into them. We have large statewide data sets now available. Because of that, we can look at things in a bigger picture, not just by county, but how do things distribute over the state. And I'll give you some examples of geochemistry and how it works, how it looks. And then I'm going to talk about the DNR Monitoring and Surveys Unit, our sister unit at DNR, that they monitor groundwater levels, stream flow, lake levels, and climate. And they've put a lot of effort into statewide monitoring and continuous recording. We use that data for our atlas, but it's also available for other people. And it's an important part of the data sets in the state. The County Geologic Atlas Program, I'm showing here the parts A and B combined. Bob showed you the status of the Part A map. Again, we are funded by Clean Water Fund and the Environmental Trust Fund also, in our Part Bs. The white areas are the areas that have not been mapped by County Atlas yet. The light blue are the counties that are currently in process by the Minnesota Geological Survey. The next color, next diff blue, this kind of Becker County, and that is current products where Part A has been completed, and the dark blue is where the Part B has also been completed. So we follow the MGS. Basically, you can consider the data pyramid. The foundation of the pyramid is the well location, test drilling, the data entry, the base data sets that Bob was talking about. Then the MGS does the surface and subsurface geologic mapping, and they're adding all these wonderful, great data sets that are very helpful to us. We use all the rasters that they've come up with and look at them hydrogeologically. But we need that information before we can start a Part B atlas. So then once that part is done, we will get the data from MGS and we'll plan a water sampling and collection and lab analysis and do hydrogeologic mapping. And I'll talk about the details as we go along. The first thing we do is we look at the cross sections. Here you can see, this happens to be Morrison County, but there's cross sections that are, all these lines are 1 kilometer apart that CWI well data has been processed along the cross sections. MGS geologists have interpreted them with the surfaces Bob showed you. Then at the DNR, we're looking for about 5 to 7 cross sections where we can plan sampling so that we can get an idea of the residence time and the changes, what happens with the groundwater, both spatially and with depth. And for example, we will look at the colored surfaces on the bottom graph are part of a cross section. Those are the sands. The MGS is interested in the tills. We are too, but we're more focused on the sands because that's the aquifers. And we look at, we use the same tools to create cross sections, and we add construction data, and the gray lines are the quick casings, the red triangle, the red rectangles are the screens. So we look at all the screens in a county, assign an aquifer to the sand from the MGS, and then create a distribution of a sampling plan. So what we do is, right now, the, if you look at the aquifer code in CWI, it's either a Paleozoic, a bedrock code, or it's, if it's a quaternary code, it's just QBAA, QWTA, it's a condition. QWTA is water table condition. QBAA is buried artesian. We want to know what is the quaternary aquifer, not what is the condition of the aquifer. And so what we're doing, right now we're assigning an aquifer Q, which is the name of the sand that goes with the MGS product. Ultimately, we want to look at more detail, how do these aquifers actually work together. We're not there yet, but if we do more groundwater modeling and do additional work beyond what we can do in the County Atlas, we might get to a better place of actually defining aquifers. Right now, we define it based on the geology, but at least it's available in the County Geologic Atlas data sets. But it's only available within a given county because the quaternary buried sand maps are not well integrated across counties. The MGS is working on it, but they're named a little bit differently because they're complicated, but we have the data for every county atlas. So how do we construct our base data? The first thing we look at is the water table elevation and depth of water table. People are interested in that, and we use NRCS, that is Natural Resources Conservation Service, soil survey data, get depth to wet conditions from that, and determine in wet soil, in soil units that have a water table, what is the elevation. We compare it to the LIDAR map that Bob was talking earlier. So we use the LIDAR for elevation and the depth information from the soil survey. We use elevation of surface water bodies, rivers, and lakes, and that's from the National Wetlands Inventory where available, or from DNR data sets where it's not. So we use the most modern available possibility data because we want to incorporate the surface water. The edges of surface water bodies are usually groundwater in Minnesota. And then we look at static water elevation in wells from County Well Index and from the wells we measure during sampling. So we look at the historical data that of static water level Bob mentioned earlier. And we create a water table elevation map. And this is, for example, is Nicollet and Sibley County, two of the more recent atlases that were published by the Part B. And they're in south central Minnesota. You can see the inset map in the lower right where it is, the location. And basically, water table here is quite shallow. This is the Moyne Lobe till from northwestern Minnesota provenance, and water table is highest in this northwest part of the county and generally flows to the south and east to the Minnesota River, which is the blue area around the periphery of the counties. The Minnesota River is the drain for the area, and then some of the streams that are incised from the Minnesota River, of course, are groundwater drains as well. We also look at a depth to water table. In this case, it's mostly quite shallow, less than 10 feet. Deeper in the valley areas, river valley areas. We're also interested in what is the potentiometric surfaces, what is of buried aquifers. And right now we're focusing on the buried sand and gravel aquifers. We also do this, create potentiometric surfaces for the bedrock aquifers. The Part A, I've shown the Sibley and Nicollet counties here. The left column is the stratigraphy from the Part A atlas. The right column is the hydrostratigraphy from the Part B atlas. And we for our cross sections and for our general purposes, we look at the till units, look at the percent sand in the unit, and categorize if it's a significant percent sand, greater than 60%, maybe it's from the superior lobe, we've colored a light gray. If it's a darker gray, it means there's less sand, it's more like a Des Moines lobe till, something that's going to be less permeable. We haven't come up with a good way to trade for the looking at the buried sand and gravels to actually incorporate the hydraulic conductivity in our models yet, something we'd like to do, but we do show it in the cross sections in general changes. In the red box is the example I'm going to show you for the potentiometric surface for this area. Note, in the this is the buried sand and gravel unit, SG1, from the Part A geologist from the MGS. All of the aerial extent was mapped by the geologists. The potentiometric surface is mapped by DNR. And we've included all the information, all the well level data we have in CWI. Those are just the X's in the maps. And note, again, it's high to the northwest, flowing toward the rivers. So it's consistent. Basically, the topography is largely driving it. And it's a fairly flat area. Minnesota is fairly horizontal, flat. Things tend to, water levels often move towards rivers in the same way the surface elevation does. They're not 100% correlated, but they're often correlated. I'm going to show cross section next. This is a high in the potentiometric surface that is showing up that would normally a bit of an anomaly. The reason for that is the Precambrian bedrock is high in this area, and so there's an impermeable surface. Water cannot move into the bedrock, so the potentiometric surfaces above this are all higher, and water. These dashed lines are equipotential surfaces looking at how groundwater flows in a cross-section view, and water is flowing again from this high down to the Minnesota River. So we're able to use having the geology well-defined by Part A greatly helps our work. So it's really important to have that to start with. We also look at the bedrock aquifers. This is the Upper Tunnel City aquifer. The Upper Tunnel City is only present in the eastern part of these counties. West of there's some Mount Simon, and then much of the western part of the counties have Precambrian bedrock, so they don't have a bedrock aquifer. So this is where the Upper Tunnel City is present, and showing that groundwater is generally flowing towards the Minnesota River, the drain. This is a bedrock hydrostratigraphy. Showing in cross-section, again, showing this information is directly from the maps of the geological survey. And the arrows outline the aquifers. So Père Duchêne Aquifer at the top, Jordan down to Mount Simon. And we look at the conditions and make potentiometric surface maps from the aquifers where possible. The one thing, right now, all of the aquifers are largely based on the aquifer codes in CWI, which are closely related to the stratigraphic codes. As Bob mentioned, the hydrostratigraphy work that the MGS is doing is looking at what are really aquifers. They aren't defined by rock stratigraphy. They're defined by hydrostratigraphy. So we are incorporating, for example, in the Lone Rock Formation, we know that the upper Lone Rock, which is part of the Tunnel City group, is permeable from work the MGS has done. The lower Lone Rock is not. So we're calling it the Upper Tunnel City Aquifer, as opposed to something that's based on strictly stratigraphy, geologic stratigraphy. Another thing we've developed recently is the pollution sensitive near surface materials. We've been using similar methods since 2006. But we've been refining our hydraulic conductivity estimates since then, and we're looking at the vertical travel time. The pollution sensitive near surface materials, we call it near surface materials because it's based on the materials, the texture of the near surface materials. It's a best way to estimate what is the pollution sensitivity of the water table. So we're estimating how much time does it take for water to travel from land surface to 10 feet below land surface. And we don't bring the water table into the equation because we don't have enough data. It would make the model hard to interpret, not that meaningful. We use two things, basically. We use the soil data from the NRCS and superficial geology that's mapped by the Minnesota Geological Survey. And the reason for that is there are two different ways of looking at similar data. Soil data is different because it has organic material and it has a slightly different rate of hydraulic conductivity than superficial geology. And we use the soil data to determine the transmission rate from 0 to 3 feet below land surface, and the superficial geology from 3 to 10 feet below land surface. And then we get one, and what I'd like you to notice is the data we've been using. The soil data is mostly Sirgo data, which is the highest quality data, but in Pine County in northeast Minnesota, they have not done detailed work. And so we're using their Statsco data, which is, the data are, I'm very impressed with the NRCS's data system. They, everything, if you look from county to county, everything is in the same place. It's very easy to use. I can set up queries to pull any data I want. So the Statsco data and the Sirgo data are both, while Oregon, are both easy to query, but the Statsco data just are a coarser data set. The near surface materials, we've made a statewide map of this that within every given county, it's the same as a statewide map. We had to piece together superficial geology in places where there was no county atlas. So this shows, at the 100,000 scale, it's largely county atlas data in this part of the state. So it's the most recent county atlas. Other places we've used open file reports, other things, other data from the MGS that have a coarser data, 1 to 200,000, and then the blue is the Hobbs and Goble map that Bob was talking about. I'll be glad to see a replacement. It's at 1 to 500,000. And then we have the information from the Lake Agassiz study I'll show you some interesting examples of data that confirms the information from that. We are using pollution sensitivity based on texture. So we look at the NRCS soil texture triangle, and we look at the preponderance of the data. For example, a given superficial geologic unit, if most of the data plot as a loam, then we'll call it a loam and we'll give it a very particular hydraulic conductivity. If they plot as a clay loam, we'll give it that particular hydraulic conductivity, and I'll show you a table in a moment. But basically everything is described as percent sand, silt, and clay on this NRCS soil triangle. So to get the pollution sensitivity of near surface materials, we're looking at the hydrologic soil group, which is defined by the NRCS. And it's related to texture, but it's A, B, C, and D. A's are very coarse material, B's are sands, loamy sands, C's are silts and sandy clays, D's are very fine-grained material. And working with the quaternary geologists, the MGS, we defined what of their descriptions for their particular units would tie across. So for the A group, it would be gravel and sandy gravel or sand and silty sand. We were able to break this out into, there's two different categories for the A group that we use for superficial geology, two for the B group and two for the C group. And then we have an estimate of saturated hydraulic conductivity based on empirical studies by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You can convert saturated hydraulic conductivity to an unsaturated, remember we're looking at the Vados zone, 0 to 10 feet. If you multiply the saturated by about 0.5, you get an unsaturated transmission rate that is for coarse material, and if you multiply by about 2.25, you get a transmission rate for finer material. This is coarse, but it's empirically reasonable, and it works well at the 1 to 100,000 scale that we're mapping. And it produces a consistent way of looking at the data when we don't have complete information. So basically we use the transmission rate here for the soils for the 0 to 3 feet and the transmission rate here for the superficial geology. And we've added a couple categories, LUS, which is from in the southeast of significant LUS deposits, and there was Mason did a PhD study on that and looked at rates of infiltration, and the glacial sediments of Lake Agassiz and Glacial Lake Duluth are very different, very slow, and water does not move much at all. And then this is just a rehash. We look at the transmission rate, 36 inches for the soil divided by the soil transmission rate is 50 something inches per hour, get a travel time. And 3 to 10 feet, get a travel time, and that's our total travel time. And then we, based on the travel time, we calculate what is the sensitivity? So if it calculates to hours to a week, actually less than 170 hours, we give it a high rate. If it calculates out to, you know, months to a year, we give it a low rate, and the more than a year, the really slow, is Lake Agassiz. And then we have a few special conditions where the model doesn't apply, or it's, or we have a special case. And those special cases are regions prone to karst. We know that in karst areas, water flows into the bedrock very quickly. So if it's a karst-prone area, as defined by a, we recently published a map that's with the University of Minnesota and DNR, and it, if it's a karstic formation less than 50 feet, with a depth of less than 50 feet from land surface, we call it karst, and we give it a high category. If it's bedrock at a near surface other than karst, it's, our model doesn't is not defined. And in the north central peatlands, where there's huge areas of peat at the surface, high water table, again, the model really isn't defined. This is the pollution sensitivity of the near surface materials that's published as part of Minnesota Hydrogeology Atlas. And as I said, if you cut out a particular county, it would be the same as the county atlas. And when we update a new county atlas, we update this map. But generally, we're looking at, we've got our ratings from high to ultra-low, with highest at with karst. I'll give you an example of a couple of recent counties that we have recently published, the Nicollet-Sibley, which I showed earlier, and Anoka County. So Nicollet-Sibley are here, and Anoka County is here. And this is a generalized superficial geology map showing calcareous till, the Des Moines Lobe, northwestern provenance, tight till in Sibley and Nicollet counties. And Anoka County is very sandy. So the superficial geology is very different. So the sensitivity should be different. And here is the sensitivity map for Nicollet and Sibley counties. It's all in the low sensitivity area. But Anoka County is all high sensitivity. So it is consistent, it works, and it's a, we, people can see this pretty quickly. It's pretty accessible to non-geologists as well as geologists. The other type of pollution sensitivity that we're, that we find important is the pollution sensitivity of buried aquifers and the bedrock surface. How long does water take to travel? We assume pollutants that travel with water, so we're assuming conservative transport pollution. How long does it take for water to travel from ground surface down to the various aquifers? And for that, we need the geology mapped. We need rasters of geological surfaces, rasters of all the sand and till layers that the MGS has provided, that Bob showed you earlier. And then the method we're using now is to look at the cumulative fine grain sediment thickness above the aquifer. In other words, how much till material or till type material is between the land surface and that aquifer. And the thickness of that material will define the sensitivity. Here's a cross section, conceptual cross section of what I'm talking about. There's a superficial sand, there's two fine grain sediments, those would be tills. There's buried sand one and buried sand two, those could be sand and gravel buried aquifers. The undifferentiated Pleistocene sediment is simply, we know it's Pleistocene based on the bed top of bedrock map, which is maybe defined by other things, passive seismic, seismic, but we don't have any drill hole information, so we don't know what's there. We want to know what is the sensitivity of buried sand one. So here there's 5 feet of material of fine grain sediment on top of buried sand one. The matrix says less than or equal 10 feet, so it's high, or very high. Buried sand two has 7 feet between the sands. 5 feet plus 7 feet is 12 feet. That fits in the high category. Same as the buried sand two. 22 feet puts us moderate. 22 plus 9 is 31, puts us low. And this is 41 feet, puts us as very low. Ultimately, we would like to incorporate the matrix texture of these various different fine-grained sediment units. Our model is not there yet, but working with the MGS, at some point we'd like to do that. We also, our models are looking at assuming water is flowing straight down. And we can't incorporate groundwater flow in models, groundwater flow or groundwater models in this category, it's just too detailed. But models that are done based on this data can inform our information and maybe help change it, or certainly help get the base data at the MGS changed. If hydrologic pumping data indicates a sand unit is different than what's mapped, that should go back to the MGS. And that's something that we're looking at long term, and I know Bob is very interested in. The way we calculate this data is we use raster mass. So we've got the fine grain thickness above sand 1 plus the fine grain thickness between sand 1 and 2, and just add the 3 plus 0 is 3 and give it a rating. 12 plus 11 is 23 feet. That gives us a rating. So it's a very simple 30-meter raster calculation. The next thing we do is the chemistry sampling. We assess the sensitivity, our sensitivity maps, using groundwater residence time from tritium. That's our best method of doing it. There are alternatives, like Bob was showing with chloride, but we have to have data over time. Although we can estimate if chloride is high, it's anthropogenic. With tritium, it's a little bit easier to look at, to tie it to a time frame, but it's very broad brush. If it's vintage tritium, we call it vintage tritium age, if there's less than one tritium unit in the water. And we know that fell as rain before 1953. And that would be the deeper water. The recent age means it's got 8 to 15 to 8 or more tritium units in it. We change our ranges over time. We used to use 10. The tritium signal is fading because it was primarily from atmospheric nuclear weapons testing in the 1950s and 60s. But there's still ongoing tritium sources, and we currently test atmospheric tritium at a weather station in Ramsey County. It's one of our climatologist weather station, and we've been getting 5 to 8 tritium units. So the precipitation, modern tritium still has tritium in it. But we're able to look at recent water, vintage water, and if it's in the mixed area between the two, then we know it's a mixture of deeper and younger water. So here's an example of the aquifer SHSV in Nicollet Sibley. And this is one of the shallow aquifers. The sensitivity was mapped from very low to very high, depending on how much sand is above it, basically, and how shallow it is. And for example, here we looked at this. You can see that it was zoomed in here, and we had mixed tritium and 17.6 milligrams per liter chloride. So this is clearly anthropogenic, but it's very consistent with this data. And then we looked at the pollution sensitivity of the bedrock surface, that is, using the rasters that Bob described, and the thickness of the fine grain material above it, and it's mostly very low sensitivity. And all these blue values are wells with vintage tritium, which are consistent with that. And areas that have higher sensitivity have some mixed or recent tritium. So the model is generally working. The other thing we look at is groundwater use. So we have, the DNR has a database of high capacity or high groundwater use and with the wells. Basically, any appropriator pumps more than 10,000 gallons per day or a million gallons per year has to have a permit from DNR. So we are able to use that data, and then they have to report water use and over time and where the water's coming from and everything else. So we're able to assign an aquifer to the particular well. We know what the pumping use is, and we can show that here. So this shows the blue area is mostly water supply wells. This is Anoka County, so remember the metro. This is Ramsey County and Hennepin County. So these are the most water use in Anoka County is associated with cities. The same data shown a little differently. Blue is superficial sand, that's the source. Buried sand and gravel, quaternary buried sand and gravel is yellow, or bedrock is gray. So it shows us where the source came from. And I want to show you the value of some of the other data we're collecting, focusing on the Pickerel Lake area and the Lino Lakes area. This is part of the published Anoka County Geologic Atlas that was just recently published by Jim Berg. So it's our most recent atlas. So I'm going to start with the Northwest Pickerel Lake. Here, Jim compared the precipitation in the area, and note the seasonal nature of it. A lot of precipitation in the summer, not much in the winter. With the water level data, the hydrograph of the water table here, the Wanawak and Mount Simon aquifers. And note that the seasonal variation and the precipitation is also shown in the water levels. In the Llano Lakes area, he compared the monthly groundwater use, because this is an area of high intensity groundwater use, a lot of pumping. And so in this case, it's seasonal highs from pumping. And the seasonal high in pumping becomes a drawdown in the water level. And what I want you to note here is in the early part of this record, from 2011 to about 2012, we had maybe monthly readings. After that, we've got like every 6 hours, or it depends on the data set. Sometimes it's every 6 hours, sometimes it's hourly. But our monitoring unit is now putting in observation wells with data recorder, data loggers, and we're getting high intensity data, which is very helpful for us. And you can see that the record's much better, but we can follow the drawdowns and the water use are correlated. But the static water level in this case recovers every year. That's not true everywhere. We also look at specific capacity and transmissivity. We do an analysis of the wells. We've assigned an aquifer code to all of our wells as possible, either a quaternary code or a bedrock code, and we use data from the County Well Index. The specific capacity is from the well development data. They might say that the well was pumped for 12 hours at a certain gallons per minute and had a drawdown of such and such, and then you get a specific capacity. We also have transmissivity data from a compilation of aquifer tests that Justin Blum did a lot of the compilation, DNR has a compilation, USGS data, and so we're using that information to get actual transmissivities from things that have been tested and then analyzed. Justin will talk more about an aquifer test, our aquifer properties database that we're in the process of putting together to get all this data statewide and available to everyone, both for our use but also for general use, and to capture it. Chemical hydrogeology. We're doing a lot of chemistry sampling over time. We want to look at three things. Groundwater recharge sources, that is using stable isotopes, oxygen, hydrogen. Did the water come in directly as precipitation into the ground, or did it come in through a lake and was there some fractionation? We want to look at groundwater residence time. Largely tritium, but also carbon-14, which gives us residence times on the order of 100 to about 35,000 years. Over 35,000 years, the carbon-14 is gone. But we've done a lot of work with that. And with cooperating from Kelvin Alexander and Scott Alexander at the Department of Earth Sciences, University of Minnesota. And then the inorganic chemistry of groundwater, I'll show you some interesting things about how groundwater evolves as it travels through the ground. Here's our data set for stable isotopes that we've collected over the years of hydrogen and oxygen. I've color-coded these. Lake samples are blue, river dark blue, springs are purple, although they behave much like any groundwater. Wells are red, and there's a couple of precipitation samples that are black. Those are the samples from northern Ramsey County that I was talking about earlier. The standard stable isotope graph plotting delta deuterium versus delta oxygen 18, the black line is the mean arc water line. Precipitation generally falls along that line globally, and it's the nature of the way the water evaporates from the ocean and then travels to the continents as precipitation. It's fairly complicated, but it actually works out very nicely along the line. And then note that most of our groundwater samples do plot along that line. The lake samples plot along this line here, which is an evaporation line. And that's based on that they started as precipitation, but as the when the lake is exposed to the atmosphere, because it is all the time, The lighter isotopes evaporate, the heavier isotopes stay behind, and therefore you get water that plots off the mean arc water line. And there's groundwater in this area too, so some groundwater plots along the lake line. We know that it had to recharge via a lake. Here's an interesting example. If you look at this graph, going left on the x-axis or going down on the y-axis means lighter isotopic water, water that's depleted in the heavier isotope. This area here is isotopic light. It's the kind of thing you'd find in Antarctica today, precipitation there. We find it in the Red River Valley underneath the Lake Agassiz sediments. So there's just not much modern recharge. This is very old recharge. It was recharged, you know, thousands of years ago. And we, our carbon-14 data indicates similar things. Here's carbon-14 residence time across the state. County Atlas has collected 8 or 10 samples per county since we started working on this data. Calvin and Scott Alexander have been doing this since the 80s. The MGS was involved. It requires modeling based on what was the surface conditions like when water came, when rain fell and goes to the soil layer, there's exchange of carbon. You have to know what type of plants and so forth. It's relatively complicated. So we have had Scott Alexander to remodel all the data. Now that he's got chemistry, he's got good chemistry set statewide. He can remodel all the data. And now we're storing the county geologic atlas data and the compilation of the data done by other people. Again, mostly University of Minnesota and MGS. But we wanted to keep this data set. It's a very important, and now that it's a big data set, it's of more use than it was with a small data set. And we also do a Piper plot of general chemistry. So we look at the mill equivalents of calcium, magnesium, and sodium in the anions. We do a similar thing with cations on the left, anions on the right, and then a Piper chart. And what I want you to focus on is the cation chart. I've color-coded these based on groundwater residence time. Pink is recent age tritium, green is mixed, blue is vintage. So note that over time, as groundwater moves, we start with calcium, magnesium, but there's an exchange with sodium over time. And we know that, and we can tie this to longer residence time has this cation exchange over time. So we can look at the groundwater chemistry. The other thing of interest, this is the Piper plot of general chemistry that we have from our data statewide. Note the high density data here is County Atlas. This portion of the state, the western part, with the lower density of dots, that's regional hydrologic assessments that were done over larger areas. There's another program that we don't do anymore because we only focus on county studies, but we do have data going back to larger areas so we can look at the chemistry. And you can see similar plots here. I'm going to show you an interesting plot on, well, I'll just show you the plot. Sulfate-rich groundwater. So if we look at the chemistry here, this is sulfate-rich. It's got more sulfate than bicarbonate. This is the bicarbonate to sulfate. It all plots mostly in the western part of the state, southwestern Minnesota usually. And so the water as it's entering the ground changes. It picks up different chemicals based on the material of the what is the near surface sediment and the flow pipe. A lot of it's the early near surface sediment. And I'm going to show you, focus on Nicollet and Sibley County. Here's Nicollet County and Sibley County. And here, as part of the County Atlas study that was just completed, we noticed that the high sulfate areas are associated with the hybrid till. The Villard till seems to be associated with lower sulfate. These are two tills, both from the Des Moines lobe. There's adjacent ice streams. So there's a difference in the material deposited by the ice. And there's a correlation here. We don't have complete data, but this is a very interesting study that I guess needs to be carried further, but it's an interesting observation. And then the calcium, magnesium, bicarbonate, the rich bicarbonate are basically the other rest of the state. So there's a dichotomy in the types of groundwater. All of our data are now at mndnr.gov groundwater mapping, a short URL that'll lead us to your maps and studies page at DNR. It's got the County Atlas program website. It shows County Atlas data here. If you click on that, you'll get a map. You can go to the data you want. Minnesota Hydrogeology Atlas, we have a couple of compilations of the pollution sensitivity of near surface materials I talked about and showed you. Water table maps and our bed sensitivity of the bedrock surface, compilation looking back at older data sets. And if you scroll down, if you go to this site and scroll down, you can get to the chemistry data and other things. So everything's on this site. Now I want to change a little bit and talk about our sister unit at the DNR. I'm in the groundwater and hydrogeology unit. We do basically the analysis in County Atlas or working with permits to help do the technical end of permits. There's a water monitoring and surveys unit that does all of the monitoring for our agency, in the water part of the agency. The climatology group is there. They monitor stream flow, they monitor lake levels, and they monitor groundwater levels. And this data is also available to the public. This is the map of Precipitation Observer Network. So they've got precipitation observers that meet. I want to check one thing, sorry. No. I was looking for some notes that I have a different slide, I apologize. This is a surface water monitoring network, basically the stream flow data. This is the lake gauge network. So we have a bunch of lake gauges that we put in. Lake gauges are installed in the spring and usually have local volunteers monitoring them. There's also, they have access to other data sets from the USGS and from the Corps of Engineers, all available, links to them on our website. And then DNR observation wells, the DNR observation well network. The continuous monitoring in pilot counties, what this is, we've gone from in groundwater monitoring to maybe once a month for 8 months out of the year, where we pay the SWCD to go stick a tape down the well, to putting in OTT transducers and having much higher density of data. And it's either, it depends on the local data, but what's needed, but it's 1 hour data or maybe it's 6 hour data. They have but we are able to actually look at things over time and compare and look at, if we want to do a synoptic, we could do a synoptic, we could look at all the data sets of time and say what was happening on this date and this general time and create a pseudo synoptic. So there's a number of things that come up can be used by this, by having someone in charge of monitoring the data, checking the quality and publishing it. We also have a database of groundwater appropriation permit locations. As I said, water appropriators who use more than 10,000 gallons per day or 1 million gallons per year have to have a permit from DNR. And as part of that permit, we require that they submit, where the well is, what is the aquifer, how much are you withdrawing from that aquifer? So basically water use. And this map shows the brown is all of the irrigation data, the reds are the water supply, and then the others are minor categories. But basically, we have a good data set over time. We can compare pumping, we can compare water levels now with our better observational network, and we can tie it to the geology and hydrogeology maps. And all this information can be used by people who want to do groundwater models, or you can do a number of different things because we have all these pieces of data that come together. So inclusion, the County Geologic Atlas data, the analysis, data analysis and reports created are all done using documented methods and procedures. I've described some of them. The rest are online if you scroll down from that mintdnr.gov/groundwater mapping. Our reports and our large statewide data sets are now compiled from individual counties, so we can say a lot more about the data when we look at it statewide. The Atlas reports cover a lot of Minnesota. So I've shown you the statewide chemistry, I've showed you and some of the other hydrology data atlases. I haven't shown you other things, but we can use this data as a basis for groundwater models. And hopefully if groundwater model is done in a given area and the hydrology data suggests there's a difference, there's something wrong, there's a boundary in a given location or something, we want that to come back to the MGS to update the geologic model. because if the data have to work together. And then our monitoring unit is moving to continuous recording for both their surface water and groundwater sites. And they've done surface water for quite a while. Now they're moving to groundwater sites. And I told you about the MPARS database and the permit data. And I've got a list of all the data on the web. This will be published online. And Sean told me he's going to have a special place for links at the conference site because we don't have to go into everybody's site. But basically, we've got a lot of things coming. The one thing here is the Aquifer Properties database. It's in development. And Justin will talk more about it. Any questions?
Same thing, Todd will be back for the panel, but we can take a couple questions right now.
I have a question regarding the surficial sensitivity. Doing wellhead protection plans with Department of Health, have you worked with them at all and kind of compared your methods with the L-score methods that the MDH uses?
We're talking about it now, looking at the data. We haven't directly compared them, but we are doing it. We're looking primarily at ways to do, the near surface sensitivity is strictly to water table.
Okay. Thank you, Todd.